Well, let me start by posing a question, which is this. Why is it that one would want to study emotion, and why is it that one would want to talk about emotion? And of course, there are many reasons that could immediately come to mind. The first is curiosity. Curiosity is a very good justification for any intellectual pursuit, and certainly for a pursuit that will give us something so important about the definition of human nature. So let's say that curiosity would be a very good reason to study and a very good reason to inquire about emotion, as you are doing tonight. Another good reason is the medical importance of emotion. And that, too, is looming larger all the time because, as you all know, there are conditions, for example, such as pain or depression, to mention just two medical conditions of the highest importance and of the highest impact in terms of human suffering. And there is very little question that we will only be able to truly conquer these conditions when we know far more than we do today about emotion. There's been great progress, but the progress is not sufficient to create rational treatments for those conditions. So the biomedical importance of emotion is quite obvious, and it would justify, once again, that interest. Something that is perhaps a little bit less obvious is the fact that emotion, that's why there is a mention to social behavior in my title, is that emotion has an enormous value in what one would describe generally as human affairs. So the way one behaves socially, the way one constructs social conduct, social conventions, and even rules of ethics is, in fact, very closely associated with emotion, and perhaps we can get a little bit into the reasons why. It is certainly not obvious for many, and I think it's becoming more obvious now as we understand the particular status of emotion and feeling in humans, and as we realize that they are not human creations, they are not human devices, but in fact devices that have a very long history in evolution and that we have inherited. But certainly in the setting of this, now we have a microphone, I can even hear it. Yeah. In the setting of this festival, in the setting of the arts, and I assume that many of you are in one way or another related to the arts, we have to say that there's one additional good reason to discuss emotion, is that emotion is key to any discussion on the arts, whichever way we want to lead that discussion. It is certainly a key for the artist, as the artist creates an object, creates a performance, and it is certainly the case that creation is very often prompted by an emotional state and very often even guided in the execution of the performance or of the object by an emotional state. But it is also equally important for the receiver, for the public of that object or of that performance. We seek art in its many manifestations precisely because there are emotions that impel us in that direction, and it is also quite clear that as a result of the experience of an art object or a performance, we get emotion. We have flowing of yet another level of emotion. So my plan for tonight was to tell you a little bit of what I know about emotion from my perspective, which is the perspective of a neurobiologist, and then allow you to make use of those comments and of those ideas in whichever way you find best. So let me just start, since we are in the setting of a magnificent university, by putting things in perspective. And the perspective is the perspective of history of ideas. We obviously are going through a remarkable period in the understanding and in the search for knowledge regarding emotion, but this is by no means a new quest. You can find wonderful comments about emotion in Aristotle. You can find wonderful comments about emotion, in fact, quite seminal in my view, in my good friend Spinoza. You can find wonderful comments about emotion in William James, who has been quite a hero of mine and served very often as an inspiration for my work. You can find it too in Freud. The interesting thing is that when you think about those giants of the history of ideas, you realize that the story, if you would relate it, the story of the study of emotion, if you would relate it to those giants, finished pretty much a century ago. And you would wonder what has happened since. And of course, lots of wonderful things have happened to this field since. But the fact is that there was a long hiatus, there was a long period of relative neglect, especially by the areas of science where one would have expected the greatest development, and that is precisely what we now call neuroscience and neurobiology, which was very interested in emotion at the turn of the other century, but in fact let it drop for most of the 20th century. All of this, to make a long story short, has changed dramatically over the past decade, and it's curious that it is just over the past decade, and notwithstanding many important contributions in the century that came before, the fact is that now there's a new ferment of interest for many, many disciplines, including, of course, the central components of the discipline of neurobiology. So after all this neglect, the good news is that we're now perfectly embarked on the kind of exploration of the phenomena of emotion that one would have expected to have seen happen, say, around 1920, but did not. Now, of course, this modern perspective is very much helped by the fact that we have tools that we did not have 100 years ago, and tools that have allow us to approach emotion in humans, both humans with neurological conditions, for example, as well as entirely normal humans who do not have any kind of disease, neurological or psychiatric. These tools also allow us to study emotion in animals in a very precise way. So we have, from the tools of molecular neurobiology to the tools of systems neuroscience, for example, the scanners that many of you non-neuroscientists will have heard about, that they give us a tremendous amount of power. They give us the possibility of entering this field, not just from the external description or from the experience, but also from what goes on in the brain as these phenomena unfold. Something very general that I have to say at the outset is already implied in what I said before, is that these are evolutionary tools. If you describe emotion as a tool for our behavior, a tool for our cognition, these are tools that do not spring de novo in human beings. They have been there for a very long time, not only in humans, but for a very long time in non-human species. In fact, one of the things that I find most remarkable is that when you observe very carefully the behavior of different species, and in fact even extremely simple species, even unicellular species, you find behaviors that have at the core something that very much resembles fundamental behaviors of an emotional being. And it's quite interesting that they are represented in the body of that particular individual. You can take unicellular creatures that will, when threatened by a stimulus that potentially could endanger their lives, will not only run away from that stimulus, but will also, in their own very simple bodies and unbrained bodies, will contract into themselves. And we also have those exact same simple unicellular non-brained species open and relax and literally unfold in situations which are conducive to their survival and to their good function. So there is something that is present in living organization, even before we have a brain to coordinate that living organization, to coordinate that life, that has very much the core of what we find in some fundamental expressions of emotion. So it's not a new thing. It's just gotten very, very much complicated with us. One other thing that I will say immediately, and we'll return to that, is that emotion is involved in life regulation. So when you look at the emotions, both the emotions that everyone in this room will recognize as clear emotions, for example, fear and anger, happiness, sadness, surprise, compassion, pride, contempt, jealousy, all of these emotions, I can build very rapidly, very easily, a story about how those deployments of emotion are conducive to the survival and to the well-being of an individual, even when those emotions at the outset do not appear to be positive emotions, do not appear to be capable of creating a state of well-being, they are directly or indirectly going to lead to that state. So I just wanted to put that idea in your mind so that the rest of what I'm going to say makes a different kind of sense. Now, the other thing I want to say right at the outset is that as part of a research strategy, I make a very principal distinction between what one calls emotion and what one calls feeling. And I'm going to stress that because it is something that is very clear in my mind. I think it's very clear in the minds of many people, but sometimes strikes people as odd and strikes people even as counterintuitive. So let me just go through it very briefly so that we can get it out of the way. When I talk about emotion, I talk about something that, for example, in the case of an emotion such as fear, is represented, is acted in the facial expression, body posture, in a behavior that we execute. And the expressions of that emotion are very clearly behavioral, are very clearly public. They're expressions that you can observe, that you can comment on. And there are even some components of the emotion itself that even if you cannot observe them with the naked eye, you can very easily observe with the tools of science that we now have available in the laboratory. For example, when we emote with fear, not only do we have a particular facial expression and a particular body posture or a particular behavior such as freezing in place or running away, but we also have changes in our heart rate, changes in the contraction of the smooth muscle in the gut, changes in our respiratory pattern, changes in a variety of molecular systems that permit the release of chemical molecules in the brain and into the bloodstream, making them available throughout the entire economy of a body, of an organism. So all of those changes are in fact behavioral in the proper sense of the term. All of those changes are observable in the proper sense of the term, either with the naked eye or with a laboratory probe. Now, once that happens, something else happens that we're all very familiar with, is that we experience that emotion. We experience that collection of behavioral reactions, that literal upheaval in our organism. Because whether it is a positive emotion like joy or an emotion like sorrow, we do experience something of an upheaval. Now, when that is experienced, then we reach the phase of feeling itself. And the very critical point here is that I'm trying to distinguish one from the other for reasons that have to do with the research strategy, for reasons that have to do with proper definitions so that we can have proper hypotheses to study the phenomena, and that's important. But also because these terms have in fact been used with these kinds of associations for a very long time, and in common language, very often they have lost that alignment. Very often we refer to feelings when we mean emotions, in my sense, or vice versa. Now, I'm not preoccupied that you use emotion and feeling correctly all the time in my terms, but it certainly helps to get this clear so that we can define the different phases of this cycle. It also helps to have a sense of what comes first. And for many people, when you think about the term feeling, people think that it is the feeling, in fact, that is going to generate those external behaviors that you end up observing, when in fact that's simply not the case. What we have is a variety of behaviors, a variety of reactions that have been long organized in our organisms and in the organisms of many other species, and it is out of that behavior, out of that concert, that execution, that performance, that really comes the feeling, which is nothing more but our mental take, our perception of what has changed in very complex ways in our organism. So this ordering, this sequencing of the phenomena is extremely important, and that's why I'm emphasizing it for you today. So let's look at what really happens when we have an emotion, and go through some of the details to make the story a little bit more comprehensible. And I will start with a very important concept for me, which is the concept of emotionally competent stimulus. So, an emotion starts, if you ask me, where does it begin? Well, it begins with the confrontation with a stimulus that can cause the emotion. There is a trigger out there that causes the emotion. And the out there needs to be characterized, by the way, because it can be out there in the sense that there is a person, or there is a particular situation, or there is an object of art, or there is a performance that is occurring, or there's a place that you react to and gives you the emotion. But all of that can actually be not out there, but in fact inside your mind. You very often emote to stimuli that you're not actually seeing. You emote to stimuli that are occurring in a dream, or you emote to stimuli that are occurring in a daydream. You're simply imagining, you're simply thinking about your own life, and in comes the representation of a person, or of a place, or of a situation that may have happened actually, or may actually be purely imaginary and about to happen maybe in your future. And it is out of one of those representations that you will be able to generate the emotion. So the emotionally competent stimulus needs to be understood in this very broad way. It is not just something that is out there actually. It is something that may have been out there and is now incorporated and fabricated by your mind in recall, or it may be something that has in fact never happened and that you are imagining, that is part of your own fiction and that you are dealing with but emoting to nonetheless. Now, the reason why I use, by the way, the term emotionally competent stimulus is that it has a certain resonance for me, which may not have for many of you, with stimuli that are capable of producing an immune response. And this is something very interesting because, in fact, there is quite a lot of similarity, in my view, between the way we respond to certain stimuli out in the world that cause a response by our immune system and the way we respond to stimuli by having an emotion. In both cases, you're dealing with something that is in the environment of our brain, to begin with, and that generates a response that has been, by and large, constructed during evolution and is available to us under certain circumstances. So, that's why we can say when we think about emotionally competent stimuli, about all these things that I mentioned, persons, places, situations, art objects, performances, that they really come in two flavors. Those that are truly innate and those that are acquired individually by our learning. For example, there are certain stimuli that will trigger fear in any person in this room. or in many other species. They have to do, for example, with certain kinds of loud noise, or with certain kinds of looming shadow, or with vibration at a certain frequency. So there are certain stimuli that, whether we want it or not, will create fear in us. You will have fear in an earthquake, even if you have never experienced an earthquake and probably have never even heard about having an earthquake. That will do something to you that causes the response of fear, not only in you, but in many other species. So that is the kind of emotionally competent stimulus that certainly came to us through evolution. We did not need to learn it. We may need, by the way, to tweak it a little bit in terms of our early experience, and if anybody wants to ask about it, I'll be delighted to tell you. But basically, we have some evidence in studies of animals that suggest that it takes a first experience under certain circumstances for the response to be fully engaged. For example, there's evidence that in very young, in infant monkeys, they will respond to fear if they see not just a snake, but if they see the mother respond with fear to the snake. If the mother does not respond with fear to the snake, the fear response may never be engaged. But all it takes is that simple exposure to that single instance of fear in the mother's face for the response to be engaged forevermore. So there are these funny little arrangements that, you know, you could argue that, well, that's not truly innate because you still require some sort of environmental exposure, but it is very nearly innate. Now, there are many other things that do not respond to this. For example, why is it that you will respond with emotion to the wonderful pieces by James Turrell that you have in the gallery across the plaza from us? You respond not just because there's some innate setting that has been tuned, say, to the oval of the sky spaces of Turrell, or to the blue of one of those wonderful pieces that you have here in the exhibition. You respond because you have actually been gradually attuned to certain combinations of certain stimuli in your experience of objects, not just art objects, but others. And certain emotions that were associated with certain classes of objects in the past. So there is something that is elaborated and that requires not just that you inherit a certain predisposition to respond to a certain shape or a certain sound, for example, a certain sequence of sounds in music. It's something that has been attuned by culture, has been attuned, and in fact not just by you, but by a tradition that you inherit when you start experiencing performances or objects of art. So the emotionally competent stimulus, to return to the concept, comes in all of these fashions, comes as something from the outside and from the inside, and comes as something that may have the baggage of the history of biology behind it, or something that may actually have been acquired by your own individual experiences, which is, of course, the reason why, when it comes to emotion, we both have an enormous amount of sharing, and we also have an enormous amount of individuality. One of the reasons why emotion exports so well in art, in music, is that there are, of course, lots of things that are very well shared. Why is it that certain historical events produce very similar emotions? Well, because there are certain arrangements that have been very well conserved in history and are ready to be engaged, and it doesn't make any difference if you are in Saigon or if you are in Rome. But then there are many others for which that is not so. There are many others for which there is an individuality. There are things, probably, that will cause emotion to only a few people in this room tonight, and not to all. And those things will be different for those few groups of people. So there is both, in a way, this tremendous amount of sharing, this universality of the phenomena, but also, at the same time, some tremendous customization that allows one to have an emotion when nobody else or very few others will. So once you have this emotionally competent stimulus about which I spoke available, how does emotion unfold? What are the steps? And here this is interesting because this is one of the areas where the work has allowed us to produce more detail and to have a sense of how these things are happening in our mind slash brain and organism as a whole. So the first thing, the first phase or stage that you could identify is something that one could call evaluation or appraisal of the emotionally competent stimulus. And that's something about which there's no great controversy in the scientific literature. Everybody agrees that some kind of filtering is necessary. You get to confront a certain stimulus and you're going to engage or not an emotion depending on how that stimulus is processed. This is fairly obvious. One thing that had not been obvious but is obvious now is that that engagement, that appraisal so-called, does not need to be conscious. And this is really quite extraordinary. So you can actually be in a state of emotion in relation to a stimulus that is out there and that you may actually have looked at or heard, and you do not need to be fully conscious for that stimulus to produce the emotion. So you can be perfectly well awake and conscious of something else, and yet that stimulus will engage the emotion nonetheless. And you may wonder, why is it that it should be designed this way? What's the advantage for anyone to have the possibility of responding to something without being conscious that you're making that response? And the answer is actually quite obvious. If you think that many of these devices came to us a long time ago in situations that were not urban life, but for example, life in a jungle, you will realize that by having the possibility of a stimulus going directly to certain key areas of the brain and producing an emotion gave the possibility to those species that had such a device of emoting and therefore attending to the stimulus, to the general area that caused the stimulus to produce the emotion in the first place, and therefore gave them an advantage that was translated into, for example, running away from a possible source of danger or endorsing an opportunity, say, for example, for food. So there is this very curious way in which our emotion mechanism operates not in full consciousness necessarily, although very often it does operate in full consciousness. And so this is interesting in terms of the way you have these many layers and these many opportunities of operation. And I think that for those of you who are interested in art, that is extremely important because we very often have responses to, for example, a painting or a piece of music that we have trouble understanding, they have trouble characterizing, and some of those responses are actually being engendered without us having a full knowledge of the mechanism of the. We don't even know sometimes what is the element that is causing that response, that is causing that emotion, and many other aspects of a particular object may be doing their job and may be analyzed in a somewhat more intellectual and cold form, but nonetheless there is an emotive element that is already working and you may not know quite why, and that's why it's interesting to find out why, and you certainly can try. On after this process of evaluation, there is something that has given us a tremendous amount of new information, which is what we call the triggering process. So not only do you have this processing of something that will cause an emotion, but then you have a process whereby certain parts of the brain are going to respond to that process and generate the emotion itself, generated across, again, several stages. And here what is interesting and very unexpected in relation to the traditional story that one tells about this phenomena is that different emotions use different trigger points. So you can imagine your brain as having not just one broker for all your emotions, but in fact several different regions that are part of different systems, and those regions will respond to certain stimuli by causing a certain emotion, for example, fear or joy or compassion. But there is no single area that will respond by causing all emotions. And this is not just a matter of having one center, quote unquote, that processes the stimulus that is causative of emotion, and then another region that goes on to produce the emotion. It's far more complicated than that. There is a lot of filtering involved. There is a lot of transformation of the stimuli as it is being processed. And then there are all of these different regions that can trigger an emotion. And eventually, it all comes down to yet another sector that will produce the execution of the emotion itself. So by now, I think you're getting the picture. You have stimuli that can be competent to cause the emotion. You have a filtering or evaluative process, and then you have a process of triggering from different sites of the brain, not one, and eventually it all converges into one system that is capable of generating the emotional state. And, for example, some of the triggering areas that we know of right now include an area known as the amygdala. I'm not going to bother you with the amygdala tonight. Or the ventromedial frontal lobe is another very important one. But the areas that actually execute the emotion, the areas where you have the orchestra, where you have the instruments that can play the emotion, are actually in regions such as the hypothalamus and the brainstem. There are a variety of nuclei that in the brain stem that are involved in emotion. And it is those areas, that orchestra, that is actually going to play it, and is going to play it in one particular theater, and that's the theater of your own body, because that's where most of the important transformations are going to take place. Because most of what is important in emotion is this production of a certain behavior, this assumption of a particular form in space. You change the way your body is at a given point. You make it run, you make it freeze, you make it open up and embrace someone, you make it have compassion for another. All of those changes are taking place in the body. Now, those changes are not alone in the body, and I must make two qualifications, and once I make those qualifications, you have the essence of emotion perfectly clear in your minds, I hope. First qualification is that there's something that people never thought about and has become very clear in recent years, is that we do not have one body, but two. We have this incredible blatant singularity of our own body. Our persons are based on the notion that we have one body. That's perfectly fine. However, it so happens that in addition to the body that you can all see in each other, there is a representation of the body inside our brains. So our brains carry with us at any given time a collection of maps that details all the structure of our organism. And that collection of maps, again, it's not one center, it's a collection of maps that actually looks at different parts in a very disengaged way. So there are maps that represent the state of our musculoskeletal frame. There are maps that represent the state of the viscera. There are maps that represent the chemistries of our body. So all of these are represented in different parts, and then they are progressively integrated so that by the time you reach the cerebral cortex, you actually have certain sets of regions in the brain that are mostly involved with representing this integrated body state. And you have a map where you can have at the same time some sense of what is happening to the muscles of my hand as I move it now, some sense of what is happening to the viscera, and you sense it as a composite. You sometimes sense one of these components very clearly. For example, if you all of a sudden will have pain in your stomach, or will have pain in a knee, or in an elbow, you will feel very well in relation to that particular point of your body that is being mapped in many of these maps. Most of the time, however, we are not attending to all those different components, unless they're really outliers in terms of the representation they create. What we are is attending to a composite state, but make no mistake, that composite state can be a state of well-being, or can be a state of discomfort, or a state of malaise, or a state of encouragement, or a state of enthusiasm, or a state of despair. And all of those composite states are being represented in your brain, and they are states of your body. That is a very key issue. So when I talk about two bodies in one, I'm not talking about strange alchemy. I'm talking very simply about the fact that in addition to our own body with all of its components and departments, we also have a representation of our body in our brain. And the details are incredibly sophisticated, and the more we know about them, the more remarkable it all appears. There's a little bit of, about it in looking for Spinoza, especially of things that have come up in the past 5 years. But it's quite remarkable that the same way that, as you know, we have a language system that is highly skewed in the human brain towards the left hemisphere, certainly all the aspects that have to do, for example, with phonetics and with syntax are very much organized in the left hemisphere. We have this system of body representation that when it comes to the cortical level actually is skewed to the right and has a dominance effect in the right hemisphere, which seems to be far more preoccupied with the highest level of integration. This does not mean that you have only a sense of your body in the right hemisphere. You actually have it based on processes in both hemispheres, but there is a dominance effect by the right hemisphere. One thing that is very important as well is that once you have this upheaval in the body and that you get to represent in the body in the brain all of these changes that are occurring, there are certain other things that happen that are very subtle but cannot be left out. One is that automatically, whether you want it or not, the experience of a certain kind of emotion, take for example sadness or joy, is accompanied very automatically by certain themes in your thinking that are consonant with the emotion. So for example, if you are, for reasons that have to do with something, say, something that you were told about another person, if you are engaged in sadness, not only will you be thinking about that sadness and feeling that sadness in relation to the person that caused it, but you will also be engaged in themes in your own thinking that are very strongly associated with the negative emotions of sadness. The same thing would appear in relation to joy, so that you don't happen to be having an experience of joy and thinking, quote unquote, sad thoughts, or vice versa. So what you have is this automatic buildup of a consonance between what you are experiencing in your body and what you are likely to evoke in your thinking process from memory, which is all coming to you thanks to a very long individual process of learning and categorization of events. So that, together with the fact that as you emote, for example, in joy, your whole style of cognition tends to speed up. And as you emote in states of sadness, your whole mode of cognition tends to slow down. It's all of these different changes that are going to constitute what we call a feeling. So to feel sad is not only to have certain changes occur in your body or in the maps of your body in the brain, but also to have certain kinds of thoughts that accompany that state, and to have certain styles of thinking that accompany that state. And to feel sorrow or joy is to have the very complex integrated perception of all of these changes. I think we should value the changes in the body because they are the central part, but we cannot forget that the others are occurring as well. So it is not just purely and simply as, for example, my dear hero William James would want, it is not purely a perception of the body. It's more than that. But the perception of the body, and that's, of course, James's great insight, is the central core of that particular state. So this now allows me to make one very important comment, which has to do with a philosophical issue that every once in a while comes in discussions on emotion. And philosophers are very keen to talk about the intentionality of an emotion. You could put it in a term that would be less unclear by saying they're keen to talk about the aboutness of an emotion. What is an emotion about? And it is very important to realize that because of the peculiar arrangement of emotions, emotions are really about two things as well. They are about the object that causes them. The object that is the emotionally competent stimulus is really the object that causes the emotion. And our entire process of emotion and feeling is directed at that particular object, whether it's a person or a place or an object. But in addition, it is also about the state of our body. So there's this inherent duality, because in order to have an emotion and a feeling, you need to have a body that changes, and without that, you would not be able to experience that particular emotion. So to have an experience of emotion, which really means to have a feeling, you need to have an object that triggers the entire cascade of processes. You need to have a body that changes, and of course, thoughts that change in a commensurate way. And you need to attend to those two things in the process of having an emotion. So you can now make a very simple definition of emotion, which is that it is an unlearned reaction, but an adjustable one. The fact that it is unlearned doesn't mean that it cannot be adjusted, for example, by cultural dictates. It is an unlearned reaction to both innate and learned material, and it is a reaction that is adaptive. It's a reaction that causes changes that in one way or another are going to be conducive to survival and are going to be conducive to well-being. Now, let me make a couple of comments, especially on the issue of what a feeling is and how feelings are adaptive and why is it that they're different from emotions. For example, you could say, well, once you have an emotion, you have this tremendous change that occurs in your body, and that in a very large number of cases can be traced or can result in a very adaptive behavior that will, in fact, be immediately conducive to survival or well-being. And you could ask, why is it that you also need to have a feeling in addition to the emotion? Why is it that, for example, we just don't have quite simply reactions of fear or anger or joy reactions of acceptance of objects that are out in the world? Why do we need to have, in addition to that reaction in the body, why do we need to have our own knowledge that there is that reaction occurring in our organism, which is what a feeling is? And the answer is that feelings give you something that emotions alone would not give you. If you would simply emote, if you would simply have a behavior, would be adaptive, and it could generate very good states of your homeostasis, and it would get you away from trouble, and it would get you to take advantage of the opportunities in the environment and save your life. That's fine. But what it would not give you, is the possibility of reflecting on it, of creating what I like to call a mental concern for a particular object or for a particular situation that you experience. So feeling goes that extra mile and allows you to place it in mind and allows you to be able to reflect on this particular fact that there are certain things that cause states of joy or certain things that cause states of sorrow, not only in ourselves but also in others. And that is absolutely critical, because it is only with that kind of knowledge, only with that kind of concern, that you can begin to construct a world in which you are mindful of others, a world in which you will be concerned with creating rules and conventions to avoid, for example, that you systematically get to suffer or that others systematically get to suffer. And it is only in such a situation that you can also be concerned enough to try to produce joy for others as well. So what feeling gets you into is the possibility of knowing and reflecting on the experience of emotion. And it does something very intriguing into the world of social behavior, which is an extension of something that, again, has come to us largely automatically. For example, we know that many species, not just ourselves, will have certain classes of social emotion in an entirely natural way without any kind of pedagogy. So you will see animals that will react to another animal in suffering and pain with a reaction of compassion, which is clearly aimed at the minimizing of the suffering or the removal of the cause of the suffering even. And these reactions are very similar to the reactions that we humans have. And a reaction such as compassion, which leads to a feeling of empathy, is a reaction that is described as a social emotion. Now, I want to make a little word of caution on this term social emotion, because it very often connotes the idea that this, because it is social, it's something that was learned, something that came exclusively or by way of the culture that imparted that type of reaction. So someone will learn, be taught in school or by the parents to be compassionate to others that are in suffering. But of course, this is not very sensible way of describing it, because we know now quite clearly that those reactions are extremely automatic and, again, probably require minimal amount of tweaking, very much like the example I gave of fear and a snake in relation to mother monkey and infant monkey. And we also know that animals, non-human, have those reactions. So there is a wisdom that has been developed in evolution that has allowed individuals to come into the world with the possibility of having certain kinds of reaction that are extremely important in terms of the social economy. And a reaction such as compassion is a very good example. A reaction such as moral indignation that you can have when you have the detection of cheating, for example. These are reactions that are not exclusively human. You can find them in animals. So you have, in a way, the beginnings of social conventions and ethical rules that can later on be elaborated in a very rich way in an ethical system. So I'm not telling you that our biology contains our ethical system. That would be very silly, because it doesn't. You know, our biology does not bring us ethical rules and laws and systems of justice or systems of political organization. That is something that is elaborated by the culture. However, it does bring two very key ingredients in order for us to be able to construct those different systems. And one is this natural appearance of the social emotions. And again, I use the example of compassion as sort of the critical one. And then, by giving us the possibility of having joy and sorrow, it gives us a possibility of modeling our own behavior and helping model the behavior of others in terms of our experience of joy and sorrow. So you have not only certain givens, such as the social emotions that are natural in all of us, but then you also have this way of guiding us into certain situations as being good or bad, and allowing us by reflection in deciding if in fact they are good or bad for the individual and for the community, which is of course what a discussion on ethics and law and systems of justice is all about. And so, once again, emotions gives us the entry. It doesn't give us the entire solution. It gives us an entry, but without that, you simply cannot get the engine started. And one thing that I would like to ask, because I've asked it in writing as well, is imagine what the world would be like if, in fact, human beings, forget the animals now for a minute, if human beings were born without, A, the possibility of reacting with compassion or with moral indignation to both suffering and cheating. And second, if we would have no possibility of experiencing joy or sorrow. If we did not have access to those fundamental emotions and their feelings, we would have, in essence, a very neutral existence, and we would have absolutely no way of knowing what we consider glory and harmony or what we consider horror, because we would not have the primitives to build that knowledge of what is good or evil without that fundamental information. And I think that that's a very, very important issue to keep in mind in relation to the emotions. And let me just make one comment before I stop and open it up for your questions, is that this idea that emotions have a role to play in our world of good and of right and wrong, of good and evil, is not my idea by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, a number of thinkers have thought about that idea, and one very particularly, and that's Spinoza. And that's the reason why I decided to bring Spinoza and neurobiology together, is that he was very keen, Spinoza was, to call attention to the fact that emotions are not all equal. Emotions are not equally good or bad, and do not represent equally good or bad states. There are, in fact, emotions that are extremely valuable to us, and that represent something that, in his own words, was a greater perfection of the organism. He didn't use the word organism, but never mind. And that emotion actually was joy, in all its different shades. Joy, happiness, bliss, whichever you want to call attention to, were emotions that Spinoza considered better, and not just better, but emotions that you ought to cultivate, emotions that you ought to induce in yourself. Practically all others you actually ought to use to a minimum and allow them to save yourself. Obviously, you want to have fear when fear is due, and you may want to be angry when that is due as well. It may be quite defensive for an individual. But basically, you should not cultivate them. And it's very interesting, because one other marvelous thing that Spinoza said that has quite a lot to do with this festival and this week is that there are ways of creating joy in ourselves that come via our intellectual reflection. And art is certainly one of the ways of creating that state of joy. Art and science. In fact, I don't think Spinoza was terribly emphatic about art. We can, you know, give him a chance and put the emphasis ourselves. He certainly was giving quite a lot of emphasis to science by speaking about knowledge in general. So knowledge gathering for him, creating a more detailed level of understanding, was a way of generating joy. And of course, we know that there are many ways of knowing, there are many ways of creating knowledge, and some of them do have to do with science and with its splendid organization these days, but some of them continue to have to do with very classical ways of knowing, which have to do with the arts in the very broad sense of the term. So the idea that we can manipulate our environment in a way that will be quite selective and will give us the possibility by continued reflection of surrounding ourselves with the emotionally competent stimuli that create joy is a very important one. And the fact that we can do that through art is very important as well. So that's where I would like to stop. Thank you very much.